Blog Talk Radio.
Radio. I'm Rich Ferguson, poet, performer, musician, author of the poetry collection Eighth and Agony, out on Punk Hostage Press, and you are listening to Poeticscape. Welcome. I'm on the road today. I'm in San Francisco. I've done a couple readings with Jerry Stahl, author of Permanent Midnight, I, Fatty, and most recently, Bad Sex on Speed. Jerry's great. The readings have been wonderful. Tonight I'm performing at the Great American Music Hall in a benefit for the record producer, Tom Mallon. My guest today, you know, you hear the term Renaissance man and may think who in this day and age could possibly even live up to a term like that, to a title like that. I do believe that my guest today does indeed do that. With me is actor, writer, filmmaker, singer-songwriter, poet, yoga teacher, and a dear friend of mine, James Morrison. James, how are you?
Hey, Rich. I'm fine, man. Thank you. Thank you for that.
Thank you so much for being on the show today. You know, there's so much I want to talk about, so I'm just going to start right here. One of your latest projects is a film that you created with your lovely wife, Riyadh, who's just amazing. You both created the documentary, Showing Up. I'm wondering, how did the idea for the film begin? What was the inspiration, and what was the process for creating it?
Well, the inspiration came from I was sitting in the dressing room at the Old Globe Theater in San Diego about 1985, waiting to go on in Richard II. I think I was playing young Hal, not young Hal, the character that eventually becomes Hotspur in one of the next plays. Anyway, a hot-headed guy. And I was sitting there waiting around with this older actor who was telling me this horrific audition story. And at the end of the story, which actually had a happy ending, but it was just one of the most embarrassing stories you could ever imagine. And we've all got them, you know, as actors, or like you, poets, musicians, singers. But I just want, you know, someday I want to do something with this. Actors are such great storytellers, and this is such a weird way to have to get work, you know. And yet we can all relate to it because we all audition in our own way. And so about 2005, I guess, I finally just went, you know, I think this needs to be a movie so we can listen to them and watch these actors tell these stories. And then we had so we started filming friends, actor friends, and we had questions that we asked. We let them sort of go off on their own, but we didn't want it to be a how-to movie, you know, not how-to audition. We wanted it to be more like, rather than the room, the actual room that you go into to audition, we wanted it to be exposing the inner room that we all have as artists or whatever, you know, whatever we are as creative souls, or whether we're craftsmen or artists or just, you know, workers among workers. So we were revealed, actually the direction of the film started out being a love poem to the artist, and we wanted to explore the audition as an allegory for just showing up for what you want in life and what you want to achieve, and how you have to keep coming back no matter how many times you get rejected. You have to keep knocking on the door, you know. And then, Well, and then once we got about 60 interviews, we had about 120 hours of conversations. We had to figure out how we were going to cut it together, you know. That was the hard part.
You know, I love how you say the idea of allegory, because that actually touches upon something that I was wanting to discuss with you. You know, you've been doing screenings of the film for various acting programs and workshops, and it's obvious why such a film would appeal to actors and really be a necessary piece of work for them to see. But someone like me, who's not an actor, I saw the film and saw how its message and metaphors really went beyond acting, like you said, an allegory, and into the realm of existence, you know, how we have to show up for life, how we often have to wait for things that are important, you know, to us. I'm curious as to what kind of feedback you may have gotten from people who've seen the film that aren't necessarily actors, what they've had to say about it.
Well, the most striking thing is when we were filming it, we had a still photographer on set with us, and he came in, and he really had no idea what we were after. We didn't really sit down and explain what our intent was, because frankly, we didn't know. I mean, we wanted the shape to reveal itself to us, just as a sculptor, the angel is revealed as they start to chip away, you know, on marble. But so he came back at one point and just said, you know, this is about what I do. And we've heard from lawyers, we've heard from social workers, anybody who puts themselves out to be accepted or, I don't know, to reveal to try to reveal what their true feelings are to other people, I think relates to this on a certain way. And the hard part for us when we were talking to people was we had to keep stepping back and saying, okay, who are we talking to here? Are we talking to the young actor? Are we talking to the older actor? Or wait a minute, maybe we're not talking to actors at all. We're just talking to people who walk into a room not knowing what to expect when they open the door.
Yeah.
And that's all of us. So that was, we constantly had to keep changing hats in terms of who we were and who we were making the film for, you know. And that was interesting. That was interesting for us as artists too, to what you think you have a target audience, or you think you're speaking to a certain, demographic, if you will, and then you realize that you're just speaking to human beings. And so it opens it up quite a bit.
You know, there are so many great stories in that film that actors were revealing about their own process with auditions and, you know, so many other things, some that just made me laugh out loud, some that were extremely touching. I was wondering if you might be able to share one or two of the more memorable stories from the film.
Well, interestingly enough, my favorite one is the one that was the catalyst for it, was Tom Lacey, a character actor out of New York that I was working with at the time, told me the story that started it all. I'll tell you the story. And then he went to audition for a soda pop. I forget which one it was. I think it was Mountain Dew or something. So they said, he walked into this big room and they were all sitting around the table. And they said, you know, Tom, and he was kind of a portly actor. He is kind of a portly man. We need to see your feet. And he said, well, sure, you know, here they are. And they said, no, we need to see, can you take your shoes off? We need to see them, because we start on the feet of the actor, and then, you know, we say this, you know, this soda pop is foot stomping good, and then we come up to him and he's danced. Oh, sure. So he took off his shoe, he bent over to take off his shoe, and he farted. And it was really loud, and he was embarrassed, and he, everyone was shocked, and it was mortifying. And so he, you know, ran out of the room. I mean, he just didn't know what to do. He left. And when he got outside, he'd forgotten his shoe, so he had to go back and get his shoe. And it was just mortifying. So he ran home and laid down on his floor and was weeping, you know, I'll never work again. And ended up getting the job because, he was the only actor they could remember from the day's work. And so basically he got a job because he went to this audition and passed gas. So it was the irony, you know, wasn't lost on me, but also it was just one of those horrifying stories that we all have. But then when we started to make the film, you know, we said, we can't, because everybody does have these stories, we have to make this more universal. So we can't make this a film about, you know, horrifying audition stories, because we, like I said, we all have them, and, you know, you can sit around and do that all day. Right. So we had to, you know, start to talk more about what are the priorities and how to simplify this thing. And as Jack O'Brien said, who frankly, the director, Jack O'Brien, finally started talking about what it really means to be human. And what, you know, I said to him, you know, we were talking about the golden rule. And I said, you know, if you just treat everyone as if you would like to be treated, and if they do the same, how wonderful would that be in this process of trying to get what you're after as an artist, instead of all the one-upsmanship and power trips and manipulation and deception and, you know, duplicitousness and mendacity, all that stuff. If you just treated each other like, and like he said, would I like to have dinner with this person?
Right.
And if you can just, and if you can go, you know, like, how would that be just to be able to walk into a room and say, yeah, I think I'm gonna like to have dinner with this person. I think I'd like to work with him for 6 months. You know, because, you know, when it comes down to it, 20 actors could do the job that you're up for, maybe more.
Right.
And the decision to make that, you know, that decision is made oftentimes arbitrarily. But one of the things that a lot of people look for is this person sane? And am I going to be able to stand being around them through this process, you know?
Yeah, exactly. You know, actually, before we leave the film, because like I said in the beginning, there's so many things I want to talk to you about because you've done so many things. One last thought on this film. What is up with the documentary these days?
Oh, it's actually starting to pick up. We're talking to and I can't go into too much detail until it's all firmed up, but we're talking to, I guess they're not really a distribution company, but they sort of are. But they're more like they don't really do marketing, but they sort of do marketing. And this is all new to us. I mean, the learning curve is pretty steep, you know, because we're indies, you know, it's ma and pa films.
Sure.
You know, we're talking to somebody out of New York who's going to help us with that, and we're screening again in New York. We just had a very successful screening, which the discussion afterward was carried live, streamed live to the nation. So I mean, it was or the world actually. I guess that's how streaming works, right?
Right.
See, I'm like still in the dark ages about this stuff a lot. But it's just starting to get out there now, and it's a snowball effect. And so, we're selling a lot to colleges and universities and to libraries, and people are starting to get wind of it. So it's just one of those things where, as you know, you have to just get out there and gig to get your word out there and have people go, oh man,
yeah. And,
you know,
and
Rich Ferguson, I did his stuff,
like you said. There is a snowball effect, and it, you know, like Tom Petty said, the waiting is the hardest part, and, you know, it's also said in your film. You know, Chuck Palahniuk, the writer Chuck Palahniuk, who I adore, he has this quote: the first step, especially for young people with energy and drive and talent, but not money, the first step to controlling your world is to control your culture, to model and demonstrate the kind of world you demand to live in, to write the books, make the music, shoot the films, paint the art. I chose to, there are a couple of quotes I want to address perhaps at some point during our show, but I chose that quote because it mentions different forms of art to express yourself, music, writing, you know, painting. And you, one of the things that you do that I love so much is your music. And you have a band, Son to the Boy, Rich Mangiacaro, Butch Norton on drums, two guys that I love and that I play with myself, Richard Peacock, Tim Burlingame on guitar, Catherine Shore doing some backing vocals, produced by a guy that I love very much, we both know very well, Jonathan Baker. I'm curious, what is your history with singing, songwriting, and how did this band come together?
Well, the actual band that's playing now is Alan Okui, keys, and those were the guys that you mentioned were on the first record that I did with Jonathan.
Right.
The band that we play live with is Alan Okui and Rich Mangiacaro, Dan Chapman on harmonica and Mark Harris on bass, and they're going to be pretty much. And Bernie Larson is also joining us on the new album. But how it came together was, you know, like we were just discussing, I finally realized that in order for anyone to hear you, and you know this, you get out there like you're such an idol of mine in this way, in many ways, but mostly in this way. It's, you know, you take this beautiful stuff that you've written, and you stand up and and you deliver it. And that's been the hardest part for me, is mostly because of my schedule, but also because I sort of came around about it backwards. I used to play when I was younger, and I would stand and play guitar and stand with another friend, and we'd play and sing. But as I left it for a long, long time and went, got away from it and worked hard as an actor. But that's still the hardest part for me, is just standing up and in the tradition of the singer-songwriter, and you can't really do it without this. And the spoken word poet, you have to stand up and do this, man. You can't just, record or make the video and shoot it out there and then, hope that somebody sees it, man. You have to say, look at me doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And look at me live doing this, because you're never, you're never going to forget. I remember my acting teacher years ago, before I started, working in TV and film, and I said, I was in my early 30s, I hadn't really started working in TV and film yet. I'd done a lot of work in the theater, and I'd been studying for years with this cat, Harry Master George, one of my dearest friends and mentors. And I said, I expressed my frustration about not working in that medium, film. Mm-hmm. And he said, listen, I saw you in a play, the Stephen Burkhoff play that I did in L.A. He said, that'll never leave me. That image of you on live, on stage, is indelibly engraved in my memory, my heart. It moved me so much. You deeply impacted a lot of lives, even if it was 99 people a night.
Right.
And so you're not gonna, your work is out there as indelibly as if it were on film to the people who saw you.
Right.
And when an artist hears that, sometimes we think, oh, I'm not getting the exposure that I would like, or that I, sometimes even we say that I think I deserve, or that I want to manifest for myself and my work. And we have to remember that even if it's five people in a dark house that you can't see, you've moved one person of those five. You've made a huge impact as an artist.
Yep.
And we forget that stuff,
Yeah, I've performed at events where, there have been a handful, four or five, six people in the audience, and I've performed at events where there have been hundreds of people, and I've been on those bills where there have just been a small handful of people in the audience, and sometimes people I've performed with, have gotten up to the mic or whatever and have been quite dismissive. All they could think about was the fact that there weren't more people there. And myself, I find that quite condescending to the people that actually did show up. And to me, it's like, sure, there aren't, as many people as perhaps we would like, but these people showed up. And it's like what you just said, James, it's like these people showed up. And if I can reach one of these people, and if that person can leave with a memorable experience and perhaps leave and tell a friend, then my work is done.
That's right. And, I was just thinking, as you said, that was about teaching. It's the same thing. I mean, if you show up to teach a class more concerned about what you're going to teach than who is going to show up that you need to reach and what you need to reach them for. In other words, if you show up to teach who shows up, you're going to do your job as a teacher.
Right.
More so than if you show up to teach what you have to teach.
Right.
And, we learned that, a lot from Frank, but what you really learn that from is just saying, okay, what's my priority here? Is it to actually try to, be of service to somebody who shows up, or is it to be of service to myself?
Exactly. It's like, get out of your own way and serve the people,
man.
That have showed up.
Sometimes, even the thing that you're teaching has to take a back seat. You really have to say, well, wow, what does this person need? And how do I twist yoga, if that's what you're teaching, or poetry, to serve that person, right?
Well, and we'll talk more about it later, but, that's one of the things that I love about you as a yoga teacher. One, your sense of humor, and I know for a fact that one of the things that drew a lot of people to you as a yoga teacher. One, your sense of humor, one, that you didn't take yoga or yourself too seriously, and also, speaking for myself, another thing that I love, which addresses what we've been talking about, is the idea that you had a very good way of gauging the room. You know, sometimes yoga teachers have their set moves. They'll go through their set series of moves, and that's the class. You know what? And God bless them. That's the class, and people love that. But you were very good. You are very good about gauging a room and giving the room what they need at that time. And that is not an easy skill. You know, it requires a real flexibility of mind and also really a deep intuition.
Well, thanks, Rich. You know, it helps to have great musicians when you're teaching, too, because, you know, it's like you guys were the, you know, if I didn't, honestly, when you guys weren't there playing with me, and we're talking about the drummers that I would have working with me, Butch and Rich and you know, Michael and everybody, but it was almost like we played off each other to the point where we were completely present. I think that's what you're talking about is in this moment now. We brought in what we, you know, need to address, and, you know, we brought in the engine that needs to be tuned, but you know, let's listen to it run and see if that's really what it is, you know.
Yeah. I want to play I want us to play one of my favorite songs off your first record, called Two Wells, and then later in the show we'll get to Love Came to Stay, one of your more recent tracks, but right now let's listen to James Morrison and Two Wells.
Thank you. out their weapons, gathering together for peace. The water in the wells will deepen, the river will never cease. When two wells drown the fear of walking hand in hand, heaven will be here. One river will heal the land. Two wells make a river.
James, I love that
Thanks,
song.
Buddy.
Thanks, yeah. Man. Hey, in addition, what was the inspiration for that song before we move on?
Oh, I was talking to somebody about an expression that their mother used to use. Had something to do with wells or four wells, or I don't even remember the context. I sit down and start thinking about. Visualize, what that might mean in another context, you know. But the cool thing about that was Kate Shore and Tim Burlingame, you know, from Sweet Talk Radio playing
yeah,
on that dobro,
and
Kate was singing backup. They're so wonderful together. But also Larry Taylor from Canned Heat was playing bass on that. Rich Magicaro introduced us, and he played on that. On that album, that was pretty exciting because I think Canned Heat, Living the Blues was like the first album I ever bought in my life when I was 14 years old or something.
Nice. As I said at the top of the show, you are a man of many talents, including writing poetry. I was wondering if you might care to share a poem with us right now.
Well, there's one I think that I know that you like. Called The Mathematics of Civil Rights that I would love to share with you, actually.
Yeah, please do.
This is from Fog Slow to Clear, which are poems that I wrote in the mid-80s, I think, probably through to 1990. Mm-hmm. And this is one of them, The Mathematics of Civil Rights. There are lives that we must calculate. I'll translate in case you can't add. Equal by definition. Not less than, neither less than nor equal. Not similar or equal. Not greater than, neither greater than nor equal. Not approximately equal. Not congruent. Neither precedes nor equals. Does not follow. Neither follows nor equals. Congruent. Or not. There never exists, not an element, not a member, does not divide. Summation, logical not. There exists for all much, much greater.
I just love that poem. Thank you so much. Are you?
Thanks, man.
Is a lot of your writing these days going into... to your lyric writing? Are you writing much poetry these days, or what's going
on? Yeah, I'm not really writing any poetry that doesn't go into a song, you know. I mean, anymore, I hear.
Right.
That's what I hear, but I have been working on a book about what happened to us when we were, with my son.
Yeah,
we're going to
talk
together.
About that in a little while, actually. I want to talk quite a bit about that. Well, actually, why don't we go ahead and talk about it now? You know, I love you and your family dearly, especially your son, Seamus. I mean, what a great mind he has and great talent and inspiration. Can you share a little with the audience about Seamus's illness, how it's affected him, your family, and you and your art, for that matter, since everything began?
Yeah, my son Seamus is 13 now, almost 14. Was diagnosed with a malignant brain tumor when he had just turned 10. So it's coming up on 4 years now since his surgery and his treatment. He's doing really well, man. He's, you know, as you know, you helped him through a lot of stuff through his occupational therapy, and you were his poetry and math tutor, man. You know, you're like, you know, your family.
Yeah.
You know, more than you know. But he's doing pretty well. I mean, from the surgery, he couldn't walk, talk, or use his right hand. So he's probably back, you know, 90%, 85-90%. It took him a while, you know.
Yeah.
But he's playing the piano again, and you know, performed in Midsummer Night's Dream here at his school. So he's back, and you know, it took its toll because the treatment is so harsh, and the effects of the surgery were pretty devastating for a while. He was hit by a train, basically, and emotionally, we're all recovering from that kind of a, you know, nightmare.
Sure.
But that said, we had an amazing support system, you know, friends like you and the musician friends we know, Magicaro, and, mm-hmm. and you know, Kalani, and I mean, you know, you guys, everyone, sort of came together as they do, you know, when a family member is down, you know, you just sort of you gather around and lift.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons I'm up here in San Francisco right now. I mean, I did these readings with Jerry Stahl, but tonight I'm taking part in a benefit for a dear friend and record producer up here in San Francisco, Tom Mallon, who's currently dealing with brain cancer, and a lot of the bands that he's recorded through the years. We're getting together tonight at the Great American Music Hall to help raise, you know, funds to defray his mounting medical expenses. So, yeah, you're right. When things like this happen, you know, friends rally, loved ones rally to help
you,
see someone.
Yeah, you look for an in, like look for where you can possibly help and how you can lend a hand. And, you know, you saw an opening there. You also saw for Seamus when for the Pediatric Brain Tumor Foundation when we had you organized the benefit. During that, yeah. We have to, and we have to raise awareness. You know, that's what it's all about, man. When you wake up,
right?
And you know, exactly. And sometimes we snooze. You know, we take naps. but you know,
yes,
when you wake up to something, and sometimes it takes a dear friend or a family member to fall ill or to fall, you know, along the wayside. You have to help them up to go, oh man, I was asleep. Whatever it takes, man, whatever it takes to wake you up. And then hopefully you stay awake and you try to wake other people up, right?
Yeah. How has this experience, I'm sure it has, but how has it changed your art or your perspective on life now that you're sort of, to a great degree, at the other side of all this? I mean, things that you thought about, maybe certain things that were sort of important to you before this happened, and your perspective on those things now.
Well, I think aside from deepening your sense of gratitude for what you have and not what you want, you know, which we sometimes lose sight of, but I think the thing that I was taught speaks to exactly what we were talking about a moment ago was the people that, you know, you and so many others brought us when we were in our darkest moments of, you know, despair and uncertainty and recovery. was, you know, you here, you know, I have to do this for you. This, you know, we don't have a choice. We need to be there for each other, and because we're in this together. That's the thing. You know, we for some reason we're in this sort of American tribal system that we have. We're taught that, you know, we've got to respect each other's space or privacy, or you know, I can't interfere with their. This is a private thing, or I don't want anybody to know, or there's a stigma attached to illness, and there's a stigma attached to based on what I refer to as baseline thinking, where we go, you know, this person has had cancer, or this person has had this, or has this, so they're not up to stuff, you know, so they're not ready for what the rest of us have to accomplish. So we need to not only not ignore them, but almost now it's time for, you know, it's the survival of the fittest thing, where the rest, you know, the rest are not as good as, or something. I mean, but those are the ones we need to step up for. And what it taught me was that without question,
right?
I mean, we literally had people. We had to say, you know, it's time. We need to go to bed now. When we were living in the hospital, we would have people come to help us, or sit with us, or be with us, or comfort us, or bring us dinner. And you know, the school stepped up, and friends that we hardly knew came out of nowhere.
Right.
Because that's what they know has to happen. And I think we learned now that we have to do that. And so, yeah, you can call it whatever you want. You can call it paying it forward, or whatever you want to call it. But really what it's called is awakening to your responsibility for your fellow, you know, human being. I think it makes you more human if you're ready for that.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And I think we all need to be.
Yes, beautifully put. You've done a lot of sort of jumping to another subject, because like I said, you are a man of many talents, and I want to be sure to kind of touch base on as many of these topics as we can. You've done a lot of TV work. One of the first shows that I saw you on, one of the first series, was 24. And as a viewer watching that show, it was a complete roller coaster ride from week to week. And I'm wondering if the show had that same type of intensity on set behind the scenes.
Yeah, you know, in a certain way it did, because you know, you have to get into a certain space to go to the intense places. You have to go to intense places in yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you forget, you know, in the heat of any job that is high pressure, or in this case, of course, because it's make-believe, even pretends to be high pressure. Yeah, you know, the stakes are really high in the moment, so sometimes they call cut and you go, okay, the stakes aren't high anymore, it's just a television show. You know, we have to fall victim to, for the most part, though, it was... You know, we all knew that we were doing something that was in the medium was a cut above.
Right.
You know, just in terms of the craftsmanship and the level of accomplishment. So that's always a nice feeling when you go home and you go, wow, you know, we made something good today.
Yeah.
No matter what
yeah.
you do. If you're carving owls out of a trunk of a tree and you know, you look at it and go, man, that's going to look great in somebody's driveway, you know.
Right. One of the things that I found interesting about that show is that you would have people like Marilyn Rice Cubb or Jeanine Garofalo, who are known pretty much outside of that show for being, you know, funny people, stand-up comics. But for the most part, on the show, they're quite intense. And I'm wondering, I mean, I know you know Marilyn pretty well. I mean, between scenes and things like that, was she able to bring a little humor, a little levity to the proceedings?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's almost though like you've got these people that are known for one thing, and And then suddenly you put him in a new thing and you go, wow, I had no idea that you could be a dramatic actor. I mean, I'm sure there's people, and I know they do because I'm hardly ever called up to do comedic roles, but those who know me would actually say, I can tell a pretty good joke, or at least that I have moments of complete and utter, I'm a clown with conviction, let's put it that way.
Clown with conviction, yeah.
She wasn't trying out jokes between but you know, we cut up a lot because, you know, like I remember years ago I did a play by Lee Blessing when I played a serial killer. It was a brand new play at the La Jolla Playhouse, and the director Des Makinoff was brilliant in this way. And as often as he could, he tried to keep it light, because if you stay in a dark place, it ends up taking its toll on your psyche, and so you've got to come out of it, and you've got to come out of it purposely. So yeah, I think there were moments where after they called cut, where you just go, phew, let's get out of here, let's get out of this darkness now and this intensity,
yeah.
And just, you know, of course there are people who can't do that because they need to stay in that dark place, because they can't come in and out, you know, mm-hmm. like an artist, an instrument of illusion should be able to. They have a different way of working,
right?
And that's sometimes hard, but that's any business.
Sure, absolutely.
You know, there are people who just have to stay in that place all the time,
yeah.
And make life miserable,
yeah,
for everybody.
You know, this kind of addresses what you just said and something you were talking about earlier with intensity with a lot of your TV and film work. And, you know, it could be said for life in general, but just specifically with your TV and film work, I know that there's a lot of hurry up and wait and, you know, shoot this scene and then cut, and then you're sitting around and waiting for a while before your next scene. I'm wondering how you deal with, you know, the boredom or just the waiting for different scenes to be shot, how you're able to stay sane, you know, how you're able to go between being in character versus out of character for such long gaps between shots.
Well, everybody's got their own, you know, their own way of spending their time, right? When they're to keep from
right.
being bored. Sometimes you just succumb to boredom and see what it brings, just like you do when you sit just to meditate. You just go, okay, let's see what's going to show up.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be treated as a meditation, in other words, but. Oh, I just lost my train of thought. I was talking about, oh, it was going to be so good. I just had a feeling.
You got so bored waiting to hear my question.
No.
You were talking about the boredom.
Oh, no, I know. Okay, and you can relate to this as a performer, too. I mean, you know, you have to prepare emotionally for what you do. You have to, it all has to do with preparation, is what I'm saying.
Right.
To come in and out of that stuff, that intensity, in and out of it, I think it has to do with preparation. If you've done your homework, if you know where you have to be, in the conditions and circumstances of the story,
right,
you can go in and out of it. You can literally switch it on and off like a light switch because you've already done the preparation. It's in there. It's done. You don't have to manufacture it in the moment, even though there's that aspect of it, too, because you have to listen and react to what's happening in the moment. But at the same time, you know, this is contrived.
Mm-hmm.
It's all been created beforehand, that situation that you have to fit into and adapt and put on like a costume and wear. So you got to wear the clothes, you know.
Right.
And,
I know you.
I mean, I'm referring to that as just having done the tailoring before you know.
Oh, I like that.
You know.
I like that. You've done the tailoring before. Yes.
And you know
exactly.
It's going to fit, so you just go, yeah, this fits good. I don't have to adjust the tailoring every time I put it on. You know.
Right. Wow, what a great way to think about it. You recently made a film with a mutual friend of ours, Jesse Rosen, called The Jazz Funeral, and I was hoping you could speak a little about that.
Oh yeah, I'd love to. Well, we shot the script that he wrote about a trip that he made with his father to New Orleans, and he wrote this great script, and we worked on it. And it's it's just a father and son kind of a coming of age reconciliation piece, and it's really, really sweet and simple. Father-son relationships are very complex, so it's not really that simple. But at the same time, there's no great event except just the unfolding of the understanding between these two guys. And I really enjoyed working with Bobby Campo and Jesse and the rest of the Bobby Campo played my son. Right. And, you know, we just went down to New Orleans for 10, 12 days and a lot of improv. We did a lot of improv, and we shot live, you know, like guerrilla shooting, where we would be in a clam bar, is that what they call it? Oyster bar?
Right.
I don't eat that stuff, so I don't even want to know what they're called. But, you know, you sit in these places, and the real customers are there, and we bought this place for the day, so they're actually making the stuff while we're shooting. And you can hear, it's sort of like the Cassavetes style of shooting where, you know, you just shoot actors talking to each other while life in New York is going on around them.
Right.
And then you try to cut together what you got. And so that was great fun because I'd never shot in that style of filmmaking. And I think it's a sweet little film. I hope somebody gets to see it.
Right. Any idea when it's going to be released?
No, I don't know. With the films that you make yourself and they're indie films, you just never know, man. Somebody's got to see it and just go, hey, I like this. I'd like some more people to see it.
Right, right.
And so that's why you have to keep, like you said earlier, that's why you have to just keep making it. And listen, without, you know, guys like you for my stuff and you know plenty of people that have seen your stuff and helped you along. I mean, that's how it gets out there. It's the same thing we were talking about with showing up at the hospital, you know, when you're sick.
Yeah,
you know, people show up and say, "Hey, I like this sick poet. I'm going to help him get better and show his work to somebody else." Right,
right. You mentioned Bernie Larson earlier, great guitarist, phenomenal human being, and how you've been doing some newer work lately with Bernie. I'd like to play one of your more recent songs now, a song called "Love Came to Stay." How's that sound? Okay.
Oh, that's great, man. Bernie produced this and he plays everything on it but acoustic guitar.
All right.
He's a talented cat. Yeah, I love this one.
Yes, he is, for sure. Let's listen to "Love Came to Stay."
Made bad.
Wonderful song, James.
Oh, thanks, man. Thanks. You know, that Bernie played with David Lindley, and so he you know, I wanted him to bring that sort of, you know, reggae style that he had with him when he was with David to that song, and so that's what he came up with. I love it.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. He was in the David Lindley and El Rey.
El Rey OX. Yeah.
Yeah. I love
that. He played with Melissa Etheridge for a while too.
Right. We're getting close to the end of time, but I wanted to talk to you a little about yoga, because that actually was how we met originally, through Frank White's class back in the 90s at the Center for Yoga in L.A. I was wondering if you could talk a little about your path to yoga, how it's changed your life, any sort of teaching philosophy you may have.
You know, interestingly, that's how Bernie and I met, too. We met like you and I did in Frank White's class. Frank White was a teacher of ours at the Center for Yoga. I came to yoga when I was in high school. I just fell in love with the physical poses of it, and I just loved the balance poses and the challenge. Didn't really understand the philosophy or the classic, you know, teachings of yoga or even, you know, the origin of it. Really, I just knew that it was very, I felt that it was very mystical and challenging physically.
Right.
But I met Frank in about the time my son was born. I came to a deeper practice, and Frank, you know, back then was so enthusiastic. He was, when I met him, he was 75 years old. I think he passed when he was 85, right?
Yep.
And, or thereabouts. Anyway, he was just this bundle of energy and vitality and soaring spirit and positive, loving energy. And I just said, you know what, he's got what I want. And so I said, you know, I inquired, and he kept saying to me, when are you going to teach? You got to teach, Jim. You got to go teach. I don't want to teach. You know, maybe I want to go deep. No, you got to teach. And so I finally ended up at the White Lotus Foundation in Santa Barbara with Ganga White and Tracy Rich, who were his teachers. We've since become besties, and I taught alongside them up there and assisted them in their teacher trainings and things. But I guess the philosophy that I loved about what he brought, that he learned, you know, from Ganga and Tracy, and that was passed down to them, you know, through their great teachers, Krishnamurti among them, which is one of the reasons we ended up in Ojai now, actually, was just that it's a, you know, like I said earlier, you know, you have to address through your practice, whatever the practice is, what it is you need in that moment. It's not always going to be the same thing. You know, your body changes from day to day, and it's even beyond going with the flow, sort of a, you know, that's that philosophy of just going with what's around you. It's actually observing and listening a little more deeply to what's going on in you and applying what you know to that moment, what it needs in that moment, rather than a, you know, for instance, when my son fell ill, my physical practice virtually ended.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were living in the hospital for the first 3 months, and I couldn't find a place to, or the time, or frankly, the inclination. I mean, I really couldn't practice physically anymore. My practice became about being his caretaker and his, and being of service to him.
Right.
And it's never really been the same. I mean, my physical practice has changed so much from that, which proves to me that we carry this stuff so deeply physically, you know, somatically, that, you know, there's stuff going on that may have happened in our ancestry, in our bodies, that we have to address. So, you know, we need to listen pretty deep to hear that.
Right. And as I'm sure you would agree, yoga does indeed extend beyond the physical practice. I mean, you know, there's just the yoga of breathing, the yoga of being able to get along with your fellow man. Like you said, the yoga of caretaking. So, yes. Yoga is a lot about the physical practice, but once you step off that mat and into the world, the yoga becomes about living and getting along with your fellow human beings.
Well, it's about it's union, man. It's coming together. It's bringing it together. Sometimes you have to bring it together. It's not together, and you have to actively make it come together somehow. And sometimes that means getting out of the way of it so it can happen. Sometimes that means, you know, finding the things to do that you can actively, you know, you can actively partake in.
Yeah.
And you know, if you're not listening, it's there's nothing. I mean, this conversation that we're having is no less yoga than anything we do, man.
Exactly.
We're coming together, baby.
We are coming together. And speaking of which, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, James. It's been such a pleasure. Usually this show is about a half an hour long, so I've just been so blessed to get a double dose of Poetescape today. But I knew it was going to be that way because there were so many things I wanted to speak with you about, and you just have so many great things to say. I'm wondering, where can people find you online, people that want to search you out that might not be familiar with you?
My website you can go visit. It's jpmorrison.com. And that'll pretty much take you anywhere. I'm pretty active, you know, on Twitter. I like to, you know, it's my manifesto, I call it. So
nice.
That'll tell you pretty much all of what's happening, and there's also a link there to showing up. So if you're interested in finding out about showing up and the record coming out and all that stuff, that'll all be on there. And Rich, I just want to say thank you, brother. You're an inspiration to me, and you always have been.
Thank you, and likewise. And this about wraps it up for another episode of Poetescape. I'm Rich Ferguson. You can find me online at YouTube, Facebook, but not the magician, Rich Ferguson. He's a great guy. I'm the poet. You can also find me at WeVoiceSing.com. Speaking of which, the show's theme music is by WeVoiceSing.com. Big thanks to Tyson and Julia at Rare Bird Lit for helping to host the show. For all your writerly needs, everyone out there, be sure to visit Tyson and Julia at rarebirdlit.com, and I hope you'll all join me next week for another episode of Poetescape. Goodbye, everyone.